So, for this morning's talk, I've got it very clear. Someone just put it out here for me again. More guided meditation. So maybe try for a talk for about half an hour, 35 minutes, and then to do a guided meditation. Is that okay? Excellent. So, first of all, I wanted to say more about developing the wisdom part of meditation, because some people always say, well, you know, you get blissed out, then so what? Then you've got to come down from your pyramid and get back in the jungle again. But in that simile, that when you are up in that pyramid, you're seeing above everything, you get a good idea of how everything fits together. That's the insight, the big world view. And some of those insights are quite surprising. You know, already I did mention when talking about nimittas, these lights which come up in the mind, and mention that you're all going to experience a nimitta sooner or later, and especially when you die. They're going towards the light. And this is not a small thing. Anybody who does start to develop those nimittas, which are not that hard to get, when you get some good advice and you know how to relax and be peaceful, to relax to the max, then when those lights do come up, then you will actually find out that why do they come up? It is obviously because you have your six senses, even in, let alone sort of Asian philosophy, even Western philosophy, which I can say this as a Westerner because they're quite arrogant in West. We always think that we developed and we invented philosophy, even though that even Pythagoras, who was not just a mathematician, was a philosopher, he is on record as saying he got all his philosophy from the Indians. So even the Greek philosophers, you know, many of them just paid respect to their teachers, or rather their source of inspiration and knowledge, which came from much farther east than Athens, way over in India. And even every now and again, you know, people talk about Athens invented democracy. And you can see in the Buddhist texts, especially the Vinaya, these are the rules for the monks and the nuns. There you see that there was democracy which was old, well established, even in the time of the Buddha. You know, which was almost contemporary, you know, with the great Greek philosophers. So these things, they were coexisted on different parts of the world, so there must have been some connection there somewhere. And of course even the language, as I mentioned, the Indo-Aryan types of languages, that there's huge connections there. But anyway, even Aristotle, one of the great Greek philosophers, always mentioned the six senses. And of course those six senses were the sight, hearing, smell, taste, touch, and mind, knowing. They always had six senses in the early foundational cultures of Europe. But, oh, I should actually mention that Aristotle always said that the mind, he called it the common sense. Because whatever you see, hear, smell, taste and touch, the mind also knows. And it's also got its own area, exclusive to mental experience. But he still called it the common sense. And so I often say that somewhere over 2,400 years of Western culture, we lost our mind and abandoned our common sense. And that explains much about the problems of our modern world. But understanding that sixth sense, the mind, as a reality, and again, as a scientist, and I was a hard-nosed scientist, you can't get more rigorous in your scientific arguments than in theoretical physics. It's more like math than anything else. But you have to really know what you're doing, and you can't make assumptions. And it was quite clear to me, even as a physicist, you cannot exclude that sixth sense, it's there. And it's a bit obtuse. In other words, just people are just refusing to see what's in front of their eyes. Even in quantum physics, most notably, a mind is there. And you can't sort of explain it away by some other byproduct of the brain. But anyway, we have those six senses, the five usual senses, seeing, hearing, smelling, tasting, touching, and the mind being the sixth. And in real life, usual life, not real life, but you know, what we take as normal life, those five senses are dominant. You spend a lot of your time seeing, hearing, smelling, tasting, touching, and what you think about is just more of the same. Working out the consequences of what you see, hear, smell, taste and touch, or fantasizing about them, and just the whole language is about those five senses. But what happens when you meditate? You close your eyes. This is one thing which I discovered as a layperson when I was going to a Zen retreat. And in a Zen retreat, you had to, not only the fellow behind you walking with a stick, which was pretty scary, but you know, I always had very good karma. I was always a very lucky person. To the point that, you know, when I was sitting in that sendo early in the morning, and just, I was sleepy, but my good karma was the man sitting next to me was more sleepy than I was. So he got hit first. And as soon as I heard that stick hitting somebody else, that got rid of all my sloth and torpor for the whole weekend. Just be. But anyway, I was asked just to keep your eyes open and watch a wall, just a plain white wall, which I thought was weird. Never done that before, but why not? And at that age, I was very willing to explore, you know, new ideas or new ways of doing things. So, there I was just watching this wall with my eyes open, and the advantage I had over many of the other meditators there, I'd already learnt how to, you know, be in the present moment, to calm down my thinking, and just to let these things be, and not sort of start worrying about what's going to happen next, what I should be doing, or going off into a fantasy world. I was just sitting there watching this white wall, quite peaceful. And then, I always like a bit of drama in my talks, because that keeps, and then, the wall vanished. It wasn't there anymore. And that was so weird. But I wasn't afraid. To me, that was really cool. That was awesome. And actually, I should actually mention as a tangent, which I promised I wouldn't do, but I'm going to do anyway, that what awesome is the best translation I have for sadhu. So when we do sadhu, sadhu, sadhu after the talks, that's what it means. Awesome. So if you like to do that after the end of this talk, to say it in English, it's awesome, awesome, awesome. So you know what you're chanting or saying anyway. But anyway, so it was really awesome to actually see this wall vanish. I'm not scared, because as a scientist, even hunting ghosts and stuff, which is what I used to get up to in my spare time, you were thinking, this is weird, what's happening? You know, you're not imagining this. So why has that wall suddenly just gone out of existence? And it was because you realize the nature of the human brain is only to notice things which change. If they stay the same, they don't move, they disappear. It is so similar for when you use your computers or your iPhones or something. If you don't click anything, if you don't press anything, then the screen goes blank. Even your computer only recognizes movement. And when things stay still, they vanish. And of course, I realized this is nothing really special. It's only a bit more exaggerated than my usual experience of closing my eyes. When I close my eyes, I first notice the inside of my eyelids. But that doesn't last very long. It's not really important, not interesting, so my brain turns off. If there's a hum of the electric lights in the background, or we have the aircon on, maybe when it turns on and turns off you can hear that change, but after a while it becomes constant sound and you can't hear it anymore. And it's the same with smells as well. As long as nobody passes wind and you're behind them, then the smell is always the same. I often thought that's one of the reasons why, you know, we had incense in the temples of old. All these ceremonies, like sitting on the floor instead of on chairs. That is one of the reasons, if you go to these old temples built years ago, they've all got these very highly polished wooden floors. But you ever see the monks polishing them? No, they don't need to. All they need to do is have a retreat and have all of their especially their, you know, the older, fatter disciples sitting on the floor. Even to you and talk, and I'd always fidget here and fidget there. And every time they fidget, they polish the floorboards. And after 100 years, you can imagine just how highly polished those floorboards are. But anyway, but when you're actually still, things vanish. And you realize that when nimittas happen, it's only because your five senses are turning off. They're vanishing. And what's left is your sixth sense. This mind, that's how it first manifests to you. That's how you first see it. And that's what happens when you die. Dying is your five senses turn off. Only when you die, they turn off for good. But what's left is this beautiful light, the mind. Now straight away, if you have a reasonably solid experience of nimittas, and you've got a brain, you know how to use it, you see, well, what is this nimitta? What is missing is the five senses, and this is what happens next. So any doubt you may ever have about what happens when you die, you know, it's that question is answered. Because it's like you are practicing dying when you get into a deep meditation. Five senses are vanishing, light is coming up, and this is what happens when you do die. So number one, you get a little bit of practice. In many things in life, you know, when you drive a car, you have to do practice first of all, you know, to training. Even just, you know, when you learn how to, I don't know, fly an aircraft or cook, you have to go to lessons to learn how to cook. And so, you know, marriage, we have to have lessons, so even marriage preparation. So why isn't it we can't have, like, death training? Should be in the universities. Death 101. Because not everyone is going to get married, not everyone's going to drive a car or an aircraft, but everyone's going to die, so it's a good idea to get some training before it happens. So you're qualified. Well, that's a little bit of a joke, but it's true. That, you know, you get to understand what happens. So when death occurs to you, it's not such a shock. It's not just, what's happening? You don't get scared because you know exactly what to do. And that's one of the, you know, you may think this is just simple, but that's enormous positive insight into the end of your life and what happens. You know, you actually almost try it out, but you have enough control, you can come back again, easy enough. Just like when you do like driving a car with an instructor next to you, it's easy because you know the instructor can always slam on the brakes, you know, if you do something wrong. So it's like learning and feeling safe. And one thing which you do understand with these meditations when you get to them, they're entirely delightful and beautiful. And so when you understand and make that connection of the dots, this is what happens when you die. You go into this beautiful light, peaceful, blissful. People aren't afraid of dying anymore. It's not the great unknown. You know what happens. And it's very delightful. And anybody who understands this knows that death is actually quite beautiful and peaceful and delightful. It's just getting up to that point which is the painful part. You know, just the sicknesses and the aches and the pains and all this, what happens before the death. Once you get to that death moment and then you pass over that one, wow, having a great time. So much so that I can't resist telling this story. It was a video made by the BBC of this woman who had a near-death experience. And this particular woman, she had so many aches and pains and sicknesses and stuff wrong with her body. What the doctors would say, she was a piece of work, always coming back. She was like a frequent flyer, a regular customer in the surgery. I don't know if you get sort of discounts if you always go to the doctor regularly. You do that in an aircraft, you know, you get sort of upgraded. But eventually she died on the operating table, and obviously she came back afterwards. But she told the story, and the way she told the story, with really strong emotions. And what she said is that when she passed away, that she floated off so wonderful, so beautiful, no aches and pains in her body at all. It was like being like a person in a prison who was now free to fly. And she was having a wonderful time when the spirit came up to her and said, no, you've got to go back. It's not your time. And she was really upset. She said, no, I'm not going back. But you must. I refuse. But you have to. No, I am dead and I'm staying dead. And they had this big argument on, I don't know, the psychic plane, the bardo, I don't know what you used to call it, the astral plane. That is big argument. She refused to go back into this really rotten old body. And he insisted she must go back. And she said, no, I'm not. And in the end, what she said, because obviously she did come back, that spirit somehow got hold of her and threw her back into her old body. And that's when she came to again. And at that point, you know, that lady on camera, BBC documentary, her face screwed up into sheer rage, into fury. And then she said, I'll never, ever forgive that spirit for what he did to me. When I die next time, when I really die, when I do it properly, the first thing I'm going to do, I'm going to find him. And I've been planning what I'm going to do to him, because what he did to me was unforgivable. She was wanted revenge. And you know, that's a pretty accurate description of that video. And you know, because so beautiful when she was dead. And when she was in sort of having to go back again, didn't want to. And this is actually the delight which you experience in those deep meditations. Gives you a taste of what's happening. And that changes a lot of how you feel when your loved one dies, or even your own fear of death. Because what are you afraid of? You're afraid of something you don't know. But now you've got some information. You know what happens. So, wonderful. You've done your job. You had a good good life. Done all your good karma. Now it's like going on holiday. We'd like to go on holiday. A really beautiful holiday. Freedom. No work. No wife. Do you think you meet your wife after you die? You can't. Because when you have your marriage vows, what do you say? Till death has two parts. So you're dead, so you must part. You've got to keep your vows. Otherwise you're breaking your promises. Anyway, messing about. But anyway, so this is actually one thing you learn about the nature of even dying and death. And that's an incredible insight to know. And then you get all these sort of other sorts of insights and just, you know, why do you have to work so hard? You always say you can't take it with you. Or maybe you can. Can you take your wealth with you when you die? There was a lawyer, I think it was in Singapore, and he was a really, really smart lawyer, made a lot of money. So on his deathbed, you know what he did? He's figuring out how he can take his wealth with him. So, he told his wife to get the two big suitcases which he used when he went on holidays, and to go to the bank, he signed all the forms, and fill them up with the highest denomination notes if they possibly could, pack them up into those two bags, you know, cash. And to put those notes, those two bags, in the attic above his bedroom, positioned right above his bed, so that when he died, he could grab the bags as he went up to heaven. And so the wife, you know, just, it's a waste of time arguing, especially if your husband's a lawyer. He's a trained arguer. So anyway, so she did what she was told, and she put those bags in there, and soon he died. And no, she did all the funeral stuff, and then she checked in the attic to see if the bags were still there. Of course the bags were still there. She knew they'd still be there. She said, silly old fool. If he'd have put the bags in the room below his bed, then he may have been able to catch them and carry them with him. Because I know which way he was going. Anyway, back to serious stuff. So at least you know about the nature of... Also, you know the nature of the body. Remember that lady, I keep on mentioning her, that Anita Murujani, who just... Now, when she went into this deep meditation, you know, and when she did, it was a sort of a near-death experience going to the light. She came back with a lot of insight and understanding. The insight which comes from a really strong mind. I mean, really, the sort of mind that said you can look at that bamboo and wow, it's amazing just how much you can see there when your mind is awakened and empowered. When you have power mindfulness or superpower mindfulness. So hopefully, that's happened to you a few times. You know, you just go out after the talk at night and you look at the stars and they just, like, they've all been polished. So they look really, really bright and very clear. Or you taste the food and, you know, the cookers, I don't know what they've done today, but they really excelled themselves. You taste the food and it's absolutely delicious. And of course, it's not the cook. It is, you know, your clear mindfulness. You can see more, you can feel more, you can hear more. You can taste so much more deeply than usually. That's a sign that, you know, your mindfulness is really powerful. And so if you have any problems you wish to solve, of course you can use penetrating mindfulness and you have all sorts of amazing solutions. And so for her, what she saw was why she had cancer. And that's a pretty big insight. You know, why? And it's because she spent all her life trying to please other people. And always being like a perfectionist. And so then you come and to actually see this and you come and get brainwashed by an Ajahn Brahm and say, are you good enough? Come and relax to the max. But I've got so many things I've got to do. Relax to the max. But I can do much better. Relax to the max. It's good enough. You're a tree in the forest. You don't have to be perfect to fit in. You can be 70%. You don't have to get 100% every time in work. Or in life. And then if you haven't got a partner yet, why not? Because you're looking for Mr. Perfect. And of course, Mr. Perfect is looking for Mrs. Perfect. That's why you never meet them. So often in my marriage counseling, it's very easy. I just ask the husband, he said, are you perfect? Have you got many faults in you? He said, I've got lots of faults in me. And I ask his wife, have you got lots of faults? Yeah, I've got lots of faults in me as well. There you go, you're a match. So when you lower your expectations of your partner, you're much happier. When you lower your expectations of yourself, you're much more successful. This executive, she put it so beautifully. She said, in my life, this is my problem. Just to sum it up very easily, this is where I am in my life, in my professional career, in my relationships, in my spirituality, I'm here. And this is where I know I should be. I can be here. I should be here, but I'm always down here. And every time I try to push myself up to where I should be, oh, I just fall back down again. He said, that's my life, she said. And so I said, the solution is obvious and easy. If this is where you are, and this is where you want to be, how about, instead of trying to push where you are to where you think you should be, how about lowering where you are, lowering where you should be to where you actually are? When those two meet, then you're at peace. Problem solved. Well, the Buddha said, suffering is the separation between where you are and where you want to be. That gap is called suffering. Where you are and where you want to be. So, yeah, we strive sometimes just because we're nuts. We aspire sometimes because that's what the world expects of us. But then after a while you think, ah, where I am, that's where I want to be. I'm really sleepy. What's wrong with being sleepy? Enjoy it. Who do you think you are, thinking that you can be enlightened in just one retreat? That's pretty arrogant. So forget it and just relax and enjoy. Then you get enlightened. We just learn how just to be. Oops. Yeah, I should actually strive to finish in time and keep my promises. So, the last little simile, which I'm going to give, about sort of how insight works. Because, you know, you listen to all these talks, but do you believe them all? Sometimes, they can try, it seems to work, but, is this really the right path? So there's something which we call, doubt, and that's, we need some insight to overcome that doubt. Because you can't just believe what's in books, even if you read the teachings of the Buddha. You don't actually read what the Buddha taught because you're just reading a translation. And even what he actually said, it was written down, but that's what he really said. Or did people add some things or take some things out? That's the trouble with translations. In translations, there's always a lot about the translator and not actually the original author. So anyway, what they call lost in translation. But how can we make sure that we get that insight so we know for sure that, this is on the right path, this is actually working. A way, a litmus test, so you know that you can trust the path you're travelling. And that was the simile which I developed, just from real life. So not from books, from real life, so you can understand how if this is going in the right path. And that was the simile that when I was a young man, poor student, spending most of my vacations up in the highlands of Scotland, just walking all over the place. And at one time I was stayed out in a tent, but when you wanted to replenish your supplies and have a warm bath, you went to one of these youth hostels. I was in one of these remote youth hostels in the far northwest of Scotland, and the warden of the youth hostel, there's only a couple of us staying there overnight because it's too far away for most travellers. And so the youth hostel warden said, why don't we go for a walk up this mountain this morning? It's a beautiful day. Sunny, not a cloud in the sky, and it was quite a distance, but I was really fit and healthy in those days. And these days I've got more gravitas. You know what gravitas means? Okay, well, some of you understood that joke. But anyway, I went up for the walk up the mountain with my friend, a local. And then when we got to the top of the mountain, sat down, usually took some oranges. That's really refreshing if you get to the top of the mountain, have an orange, sit down, watch a beautiful view. And then there's another mountain not far away, it was still there. He said, let's go up to the other mountain. He said, no, I'm going back. One mountain a day is enough for me. And so I went up the other mountain alone, which was a mistake, because the weather changed incredibly fast. Clouds came in from the North Atlantic, faster than I could ever imagine. And by the time I was really close to the top of the other mountain, those clouds came down. I was enveloped in mist. And it was so thick that I could not see, only just see the hand in front of me when I extended it. But I was always super confident. Some would say super arrogant. There's hardly any difference between the two. Even these days, I try to be humble. But I always thought a long time ago, if you're humble, you should flaunt it. Otherwise, what's the point of being humble if nobody knows about it? Funny joke. But anyway, so I was arrogant. I thought, oh, this is no problem. I know the way I came. So I retraced my steps. And that's, I really got a shock because I almost fell over. Literally one step away from falling to my death. There's a cliff right in front of me, one step away. And later on I looked at the maps, there's only one cliff, that depth, and that was totally the opposite direction I thought I was going in. If I'd been slightly heedless, I wouldn't be here today. And that was scary. And I knew that those mists sometimes lasted for days. And you could go around in circles, and or, you know, just get so tired, you get hypothermia, and you know, so many things can go wrong with you. And I started to get scared. This was, you know, life-threatening. Lost in the mountains, alone, sort of in the mist, which will last for days. So, what do you do? And I just stopped and relaxed, and just to the max. Well, not really to the max, but a long way. And then, what should I do? I happened to see a little stream, a little brook, where there's water and mountains, there's always little rivulets going somewhere. And I thought, that rivulet must go down. Because never in my life have seen water going up. So I decided to follow it. Because I knew if I followed that little brook, which then another little brook came into it, and a rivulet turned into a little stream, a bigger stream, there's more bodies of water joined in, and I was always going downhill. And to me, that was the most important. As long as I went downhill, followed that water, I would go down, 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 and down, until I was underneath the mist. You can see the mist on the mountains. They only go to a certain level. Once you get underneath the mist, you can see where you are. And that's what I did, and found my way underneath the mist. I was a long way away. It wasn't, not at all the shortest cut back to the youth hostel, but I was underneath the mist, and I could see my way. And I use that to, you know, the difficulties we have with meditation or with spiritual life. Now, who's giving the right teachings? You know, some people get up there and they've got hundreds and thousands of disciples. They go on YouTube and people come from all over the world to see them. Does that mean that what they teach is right? Sounds good. But is it right? Is it for you? So, instead of just believing what this fat old English monk tells you, instead of that, you find what we mean by the stream. So you follow it. So if this meditation, this path, is leading to more peace, more happiness, more sense of contentment, joy, tranquility. If you can't see it, the people you live with can. If it's going in that right direction, then follow it. So that's the way you can overcome your doubts. Now, is this the right way? Well, just follow it for a while and see how it works. If it makes you more of a pain in the neck for the people you live with, makes you more tight and tense, more unhappiness, more sickness, then it must be going in the wrong direction. So that is actually the great sort of wisdom and insight in how you know you're going in the right direction. And it also ties in with one of those similes in Buddhism. When you get underneath the mist, it's called being a stream winner. You can actually see the directions. You know which way to go. You know what the problem is. In the past, you've been in this mist of delusion, not knowing who you are, what you're supposed to do in life. You get underneath that mist, you can see your directions, where you want to go in life, and how to get there. So there's a little simile about the insights which happen when you meditate, which is now what I promise we will do. A guided meditation for 20 minutes. So, here we go. Now, in this particular guided meditation, many times people ask the question, yeah, I know I should let go. I know letting go is the key to meditation and happiness, but how do I let go? Ajahn Brahm, I know I should do, but how am I supposed to let go? So this is a letting go meditation. So close your eyes. I just noticed, because I said this earlier, when you close your eyes, you can see the inside of your eyelids. Have a look, and they're there. But after a while, you won't be able to see them anymore. The sense of sight will turn off. Stillness. Things don't move. And the brain feels there's no business there. So we'll turn to something else. And we become aware of our body, our physical feelings. Physical sensations makes a better translation. And how are they? No, we are going to be kind to our body. We're going to let go of all these theories. Everything you've been taught about how you should be sitting meditation. And you're going to feel what it's like in this moment with your body. And whether you can improve upon this. Never let the theory, your knowledge, your learning, never allow any of that to stand in the way of truth. The truth of your own experience right now of how your body is. Doesn't matter how it should be or what the books say it should look like. How actually is it right now? Once you're with your body, then you can be kind to it. It's almost as if you look at your body like somebody else, a friend, like a twin. You always go around with them. But a lot of times we treat our body like a slave or like a maid who does the housework for us. Now, we treat our body with respect like a friend. Body, how are you? What can I do for you? Do you want to be adjusted or scratched or do you want to be moved? And just for example, my right leg says, yeah, no, you can make me more comfortable than this, so I'm going to adjust my sitting posture. It's like when you pass somebody and you ask, how are you? How's the meditation going? I've done that to a few of you just as I've been walking past. And sometimes you say, oh, you know, this monk cares about me. You know, he doesn't sort of control me. He's just really honestly interested in my physical well-being. And what happens? Actually, the body and the mind just delights in being respected. It's the same when you look at your body and you say, legs, how are you? And just the fact that you care, that you respect these parts of your body, it just encourages the body to be more at peace. A little bit of attention goes a long way in healing. And that attention is your own mindfulness and kindness. So I'm aware and kind to my legs. I'm aware and kind to my body, to my bottom, sorry. It's like I ask, are you okay down there? Do you need some shifting or some fidgeting? The kindness gets my body into a beautiful posture. My back, stretch the back. I like stretching the back, you don't have to do that. Whatever is comfortable for your back, your shoulders, relaxing them, your hands, wherever they feel comfortable, and your head on top of your neck, and even sometimes, I know that you're not supposed to be able to feel any sensations in your brain. There's supposed to be no nerve endings there. But I just imagine my brain inside my skull sometimes works way too hard. And so I just imagine, visualize, taking my brain out from my skull, putting it into a little bed on a nice soft cotton pillow, and tucking it in with a nice warm duvet and say, brain, you take a rest too now. You've worked too hard. Relax. Even though it's an impossible simile to do in real life, still it actually works for me. And once my body is reasonably relaxed, now I'm going to take it further by letting go of the past and future. How I do that? Well, I visualize again, I imagine that I am holding two heavy bags, like I've been shopping. Or have two heavy suitcases which I'm carrying. And the bags are really heavy. And I've obviously been carrying them a long time because my shoulders ache and my arms hurt. I'm sure you've all done that from time to time, so you know what it feels like. But then I happen to glance at the bag in my left hand. And like many bags, they have sayings or signs or labels on them. My bag in the left hand has got four letters written on the outside. And I look at those letters and they are P-A-S-T. It's the past. Because this is a bag in which I put all my memories, mostly bad ones, but also some good ones as well, buried there amongst all of those problems and difficulties from my past. And that bag is full, jam-packed with all my memories, both good and bad. And I've been carrying them for far too long. just like a real bag, if you carry it for so long, makes your arms ache and your shoulders hurt. This bag of the past, it makes my heart tired and my brain weary. And then I notice the bag in my right hand. That too is full to almost bursting. And on that bag are written the letters FUTURE, the future. Because in that bag are all my plans, my hopes, my dreams, and my anxieties, which I've been carrying around for such a long time too, without rest. And that makes, the real bag makes my arm and shoulder hurt. The past, which I similarly carry around, that makes me tired. It makes my heart just so exhausted that I get angry and upset the people I love. Because I'm tired. Carrying around the past and the future without rest. And once I've imagined, I've felt those two bags and how heavy they are and just how tired it makes me, then I focus my imagination on the bag in the left hand, the past. All my past. And I notice how heavy it is, really a burden. Then I imagine, visualize leaning to the left as my spine leans to the left. And that allows me to lower the bag in my left hand. So lower it, lower it, and lower it. It gets closer and closer to the ground. And when it does meet the ground, something happens. All the weight vanishes as it meets the floor. And that allows me to unclench my fingers, to move them away from the handle, to straighten my back and move my left hand and arm up to my side. And I look down, and there is that bag with PAST written on it, but now being supported by the ground. And I've let it go. And even though I put it down for a while, I know sometimes, unfortunately, that no one is going to take that bag away from me. It's going to be there for me when I decide to pick it up again. But right now, I need the rest. I've let it go. And then I visualize the bag in my right hand with the future, with all my fears and anxiety, my plans, my dreams as well. So heavy that my arm aches. And I imagine leaning to the right now, allowing me to lower the bag in the right hand closer and closer to the ground. And when it meets the ground, the weight, the heaviness vanishes. It allows me to let go of the handle. Move my right hand and arm up to my side. So that can relax too. I've let go of the future. And when I look down, I can see the bag which was in the left hand and the bag which was in the right hand, the past and future. And I'm standing between them in this wonderful place between the past and the future. Call the present moment, now. And I'm doing this because I deserve to. I need to relax. I've let go of past, and let go of future. And I feel how delightful that feels. And throughout the meditation, I resolve I'm not going to pick up those bags until the meditation is completed, which will be in about 5 minutes. I will now be quiet. Getting close to the end of this meditation. If you really want to pick up those bags, or you're happy to leave them down there a little longer. When we enjoy the fruit of letting go, the freedom, the peace, the lightness, that insight, that understanding, encourages us to let go again, another time, another place. So you may open your eyes now. Let's see, visualization of the shopping bags And if you're like me, you don't go shopping. Suitcases. Excellent. So, not cider this time. Awesome. 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 Actually, cider sounds better, but I thought I'd put it that way. Very good. Okay, so I've got some interviews for those who put your name down. At 10 past 10, every fortnight is one of the responsibilities that being a senior monk, I have to give a quick talk to the bhikkhunis, make sure they're okay. A little acknowledgement. They call it owada. So at 10 past, I have to finish the interviews precisely at 10 past because the nuns are going to be ringing in. Very good.